You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, May 17th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a great show for you today. Matt Taibbi, political reporter from Rolling Stone magazine, will be here to talk to us about the clear law-breaking Goldman Sachs has been up to, was up to, maybe still is, who knows. Also later on this program, Republican clown car getting a little bit lighter. There's going to be, who knows, maybe they'll fit more in another way. A couple of people jumped out. The lure of cash, just too great for them. Meanwhile, I was just on CNN this morning. They didn't tell me what the segment was. They did not tell me what the segment was, and so I went in there assuming a typical segment, and it turned out to be like this, tell three jokes in 20 seconds. I'm in a room, all of a sudden I hear a voice that says, okay, well, it's 20 seconds, whatever, it was fine. But of course the topics were Arnold Schwarzenegger. Turns out Arnold Schwarzenegger, sort of a douchebag. Who knew? I wonder if those women who he fondled knew. Allegedly fondled. But it turns out he had a child with his maid, his married maid, has another 10-year-old child. That's nice. I don't like to get into people's personal marriage situations. That's for them. Marriage is hard. I understand that. Of course, raising kids is hard, too. I don't know if I would. What's the point? You're gonna head over to the buffet, you got a sandwich, you want to get a kid? I don't know how that works out. But all I can say is, thank goodness, Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed those two different gay marriage bills. Because God only knows what it would have done to the institution of his marriage if he had allowed gay people to get married. He could have 14 different kids from 14 different women. So kudos to Schwarzenegger. If he had actually allowed for gays to marry in California, I mean, one could only imagine the havoc it would have wreaked on his marriage and others, because of course he was protecting the sanctity of a marriage between a man and a woman and his maid and her husband and all of their children. And I also would be remiss if I didn't say that Schwarzenegger is not getting any credit, zero credit, for not asking his parents to pay off the husband of the maid with whom he had a child. Because that seems to be the Republican MO. So I want to put those two things on one hand. Yeah, you can say Schwarzenegger, not a great guy, cheating on his wife, having a kid with another woman. The woman, of course, was his 20-year, had been working in the house for 20 years. That's a check mark against him. On the plus side, managed to keep gays from marrying, which probably prevented him, Schwarzenegger, from having multiple children with multiple women outside of the house. and also never asked his parents for money to pay off the maid's wife, husband. So kudos to...
Do you remember, Schmitty, when I told you you would be the last to die? I lied.
So that's Schwarzenegger. And it turns out Paul Ryan not going to be running for that Senate seat that Herb Kohl has resigned from. Tommy Thompson's going to run. He, of course, supported Barack Obama's and the Democrats' Affordable Care Act. That's going to be a tough sell to the morons who still vote Republican anywhere, frankly, but certainly in Wisconsin. But let's move on to something different, folks. New York investigates bank's role in fiscal crisis. Eric Schneiderman, the New York Attorney General, has requested information and documents in recent weeks from three major Wall Street banks about their mortgage security operations during the credit boom, indicating the existence of a new investigation into practices that contributed to billions in mortgage losses. Officials in his office have also requested meetings with representatives of Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. We will talk to Matt Taibbi as we take this break. Matt Taibbi, the only reporter, as far as I can tell, who is reporting on this blockbuster Senate investigation, which, to hear Matt Taibbi tell it, and he's told it to me before I interviewed him yesterday for Ring of Fire this weekend, double shot. There seems to be some clear lawbreaking going on with Goldman Sachs. I know that we've all believed it, we've all sensed it, and now there seems to be some documentary evidence. We'll be right back. We'll talk to Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. All right, we are back. Sorry for the delay, folks. On the phone, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine. Welcome back to the Majority Report, Matt.
What's going on, Sam?
Not much. We should have played the. We have a clip of your Meghan McCardle thing. We'll play it after you go. You were already there. You already remember what it was.
Yeah, I remember it.
So wonderful. So. Let's talk about this piece. I think you and hopefully our Attorney General in New York State were the only two people in the country, as far as I can tell, who were paying attention to what the Senate was doing. First, tell us about this investigation. Who is investigating Goldman Sachs and a couple of these banks, and why?
The Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which is headed by Senator Carl Levin of Michigan and Republican Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, they did this huge two-year investigation of the mortgage bubble, and they focused on three companies, Washington Mutual, Goldman Sachs, and Deutsche Bank. And their results of the report just came out about a month ago. And what they really did is they kind of drew this huge panoramic portrait of the fraud that went on in the years leading up to the crash in 2008. And they just looked specifically at those three case studies.
And you know, you outlined the findings, and we're going to talk about that. But how did Chuck Schumer allow this to happen? I mean, honestly, this investigative committee seems to have gone completely under the radar. I haven't heard anybody talk about its existence, at least, you know, in recent times. From a political standpoint, how did, am I so jaded that I find it hard to believe that anybody was working on this?
It is a little bit surprising, and I think some of the people that I talked to in the Hill were a little surprised at the aggressiveness of this report, especially considering that it was somewhat genuinely bipartisan. I think Coburn's office definitely had some input into this report, and normally what you'd expect from a bipartisan committee is a kind of agnostic historical review of a problem that kind of identifies issues but doesn't sort of point the finger at individuals. That's exactly the opposite of what went on in this report. This report is a full-blown balls out, j'accuse type of thing, where they're really, kind of throwing the book at three companies, and in particular, one still thriving company in Goldman Sachs.
And I want to just give you kudos for the French dropping on the show. That, you get extra bonus points for that.
Finally got some use out of that high school education.
So, all right. So we have this report. It's come out. It's a 650-page report.
Right.
It is interesting in that it's bipartisan. It's interesting that, relative to the fiscal emergency report that came out, that Blue Ribbon Commission, the Republicans didn't issue their own competing reports because of the use of words like fraud or Wall Street or something like that. And so we have this report. What tell me about the sort of the general surrounding. One of the things that it came out of this was that there has been an incredible decrease in the oversight of this sector.
Yeah, that's one of the things that the report talks about is and you have to kind of go back in time here. If you go back to the late 80s and the early 90s, regulation was done in a completely different way. Your typical bank had a regulator from, it might have been the OCC, the Office of Comptroller of Currency, or the OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, or the FDIC. He would have somebody practically living on site at the banks, going through your books, going through your loans, because, after all, banks, particularly commercial banks, obviously are federally insured. And so the state has an interest in making sure that everybody's safe, that there isn't a whole lot of deadly leverage on everybody's books, and that, depositors are going to get paid.
And they're federally insured because we saw during the Great Depression, we saw what happened when you have banks making crappy loans and they go under. It wreaks havoc on the entire financial system.
Absolutely, absolutely. It creates a kind of a third world situation where nobody's everybody's afraid to do business with everybody else because nobody. You always have to be weighing the solvency of all your business partners. Nobody wants to be in that situation, and that's why we put in these controls. But in the last 20 years or so, they've kind of eroded that whole process through a series of regulatory changes. And by the time we got to the mortgage bubble, the years that we're talking about here, this process was almost completely voluntary. There were no longer people from the OTS or the OCC or the FDIC or the Fed, sniffing around everybody's books. They relied upon the banks themselves to send voluntary disclosures to the regulators, telling them, about bad loans and other trends on the books. And Goldman was one of the banks that kind of pushed for those changes.
And you quote in your piece, or I quoting for your piece, in 1995, according to an independent study, banking regulators filed 1,837 referrals during the height of the financial crisis between 07 and 010, just 72.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Again, these banking regulators, they don't have their own prosecutorial power. So the way they would build a case is the investigators would go through, they'd gather all the evidence, and then they'd kind of hand it to the Justice Department and say, here, run with this. There was a criminal case. And that's how you got, for instance, during the SNL crisis, they actually put 1,700 or 1,800 people in jail during that time period through this process. But, as the stats you just cited show, they essentially stopped doing that this decade. They really, as a matter of course, do not make referrals anymore. And in fact, when I called the OTS to ask about this, they very humorously were offended and said, "Well, what your statistics leave out is that we do a lot of verbal referrals." In other words, like we get on the phone and we tell somebody at the Justice Department, "Hey, you should check this out." I mean, it's just not serious. It's no longer a serious process.
Or you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt, maybe the bankers really, really, really complied.
Right. Well, I mean, that was, you know, we're laughing about it, but that's kind of what everybody
that's
was
what they were
on.
They were claiming, right? I just wanted you guys to know we're complying, everything's fine,
right.
No problems here. So
nothing to see here.
So you have so let's go now and focus on Goldman. These guys were able to essentially leverage extraordinary amounts of money, lend as much as they want, where they want, whatever. But now you have Goldman. What are the things that Goldman Sachs did that are now clearly illicit?
Yeah, I'm going to back up just a little tiny bit here and talk about the bigger picture, just because it kind of plays into what Goldman did. The chain of fraud here usually started with a company like Countrywide or New Century, right? So you had these kind of gigantic warehouse lenders that were using every trick in the book to create as many loans as they could. You know, they were doctoring applications. They were using whiteout to substitute a good borrower's information in place of a bad borrower's, or they were pushing people who, you know, could have gotten fixed rate loans into more risky option ARM loans. They were taking people who weren't citizens. They were doing all kinds of faking credit scores, doing all this stuff just to create loans, right? Because the banks had created this method of converting crappy loans, like these subprime loans, into AAA rated securities. They used these derivative structures called CDOs, and it's just a whole bunch of hocus pocus math that allowed them to take all that crap and turn it into AAA rated investments, which are worth as much as like treasury bills. All right.
And we should also say that at this point too, that, you know, when Countrywide has no stakes in the loan being paid back, because all they're doing is basically servicing the loan in that moment and then selling the value of the note to somebody else. They have no skin in the game.
No, of course not. These guys were making these loans and they were getting rid of them 10 minutes later. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. Right. They weren't holding on to this stuff for any length of time. As soon as they were securitized, in other words, chopped up into little bits for sale into securities, they were off the lender's books, and then they were on the books of a company like Goldman Sachs, which then basically repeated exactly the same process. They got these loans, and they were trying to move them as quickly as possible to the next sucker down the line, who was typically like either a pension fund or a foreign bank or maybe another bank or a hedge fund. And that was the scam. You took a whole bunch of really, really risky, you know, not very worthy subprime loans, you converted them magically into AAA-rated securities, and then you sold them to people all around the world as solid gold, when, of course, they really were not. So that's the backdrop.
Now, I just want to point out one thing, too, in this dynamic, because this is really important as we go in to talk about Goldman, is that there was a lot of people out there who wanted to buy these things at that time. And they were looking for some investment that was going to give them a higher return, because we knew that Treasury bonds at that point were you know, and still are kicking off very little interest. And so there was a real market there that was sort of pre-existing in a way. And in this function, Goldman is acting as a sort of a broker. It's just sort of like, you want to buy this stuff? We'll go find it for you.
It actually goes even farther than that. A lot of these companies were required to have a certain amount of AAA-rated assets on their books to meet reserve requirements, whether it's insurance companies or other banks. I mean, you have to have, you know, liquid cash assets on your books to meet regulatory requirements. So a lot of these companies, these customers, they, like as you said, they wanted to have this stuff because it paid higher rates of return than treasury bills or municipal bonds or whatever else. So there was this huge, vast market for this stuff that was actually, you know, deadly and toxic and not really worthwhile. So anyway, so Goldman was sitting atop a whole bunch of these assets. They had accumulated a huge long position by the end of December of 2006, partially by accident, because they had created this index to invest in mortgages, and they just had bought a whole bunch of stuff that they intended to resell later. But they were worried that they were going to get creamed on the mortgage market, so they kind of engaged in this conscious strategy to unload all their crap on their clients. And then they did that. Not only did they not tell their clients that they had this negative opinion of their inventory, but they didn't tell them that they were also betting against it at the same time. And that's kind of what Goldman did. They sold stuff that they knew was going to blow up, and then they bet against it at the same time. They didn't tell their clients about it, and then when they got called to Washington, they lied about it.
Okay, so now let's unpack this a little bit. At the end of 2006, Goldman has $6 billion worth of these assets, and they're sitting there. Now, a buddy of mine will say, well, look, it's their job to sell this. Everybody hedges against this stuff. So everything that Taibbi's talking about, that's called business. Mm-hmm. And so how is this different from the pristine confines of just business?
Okay, well, there's two things here. Number one, yes, absolutely, you do need to hedge. And if you have a $6 billion long position, it certainly would make sense to create a $6 billion short position to offset that, or a hedge of some kind, so that you don't take any losses. That's, you know, a broker-dealer doesn't really want to be in the business of gambling. It really just wants to be making money on the commissions, the transactions. But Goldman went beyond that. They went beyond even, and they ended up with a $16 billion short position. So they were no longer just hedging. They were full-blown betting. They had come to the conclusion that this market was going to explode, and they went well beyond hedging into this world where they were actually creating this huge bet. And, in fact, there's an email in one of these in the Levin Report documents where a very high-ranking official says very openly, this is not a hedge. You know, this we're making a bet here. So there's that, and then there's also the fact that, yes, you know, companies should be allowed to get rid of their bad inventory, but you have to tell your clients that you have, you know, if you're betting against them. You can't, you know, that's what we have securities laws for. You're not allowed to lie to people and say that you don't have an interest in this. You have to disclose that.
Yeah, and talk about some of the representations they made about these assets that they sold to their clients, because they told them that this wasn't stuff that they were holding in reserve. These weren't bets that actually the Goldman Sachs had made. This was stuff that they were actually actively going out and finding as of the request of their clients.
Right, yeah, and like in one deal, for instance, in the Hudson deal, they told their clients that the assets in the deal had, quote-unquote, been sourced from the street. In other words, that they had gone out in the open market and bought this stuff. The reality was that this was all Goldman's own inventory. And, you know, that's a highly pertinent fact. You know, if you're buying a bunch of securities from somebody, you know, you definitely would want to know that if the company owned the stuff itself and was desperate to unload it, that's a fact you'd probably want to know, right? And that's what they call a material fact, and Goldman was definitely required to disclose that, and they didn't do it.
So in this instance, and just, you know, I want to belabor this point, because, you know, for those of us like myself who don't really fully grasp this stuff, Goldman was presenting themselves as a broker. There are people
right
out there who have this stuff. We're going to broker the deal, as opposed to being an actual vendor. We have created these products. We have pooled these things. Could they get away with saying, well, when we said that we bought these in the open market, we did. We just had bought them in the open market a while back. What's the distinction there?
Yeah, they actually made an argument similar to that in response to some of the investigators. In fact, when one of the investigators asked one of the Goldman guys, like, yeah, how can you tell your clients that, you know, you bought this stuff off the street when in fact it came out of your own inventory? Well, the Goldman's answer was, well, we are the street. You know, if we're buying it from ourselves, then that's no different from buying it from the street. But that's not really an answer. I mean, that's just parsing semantics and trying to worm your way out of the reality of the situation.
And so they also made they also had an obligation, right, of to tell their clients that they were betting against it. And you can see that they sort of fudged that by telling their clients that they were actually that their interests were aligned with their clients because they had bought 6 million of the offering. Without telling them that they had bet $16 billion against it.
It was $2 billion actually in that one. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, in one of the deals, they actually say affirmatively, you know, our interests are aligned with yours because look, we own $6 million worth of this deal that we're selling you. But they left out the part that they had done a $2 billion bet against it. And it was what's amazing in that deal is that when some of the clients, when you know, it immediately started losing money. Again, this is like a car that doesn't even make it to the first stoplight. You know, the engine's already exploding before it, you know, as soon as it comes out of the lot, and the clients are instantly telling Goldman, "Hey, can you sell whatever's left? You know, so we don't get completely creamed." Goldman stalled and refused to sell because the lower this stuff went in value, the more money they made because they had this gigantic short position on the other side of it. And I know all this stuff sounds complicated, and people are going to say, well, why should I care that one bank screwed another? But the problem is ultimately all of this fleecing ended up coming out of our pockets because of the bailouts, because of the bailout of AIG. You know, this ultimately, you know, is really just theft from all of us.
And so, and who else, who were these clients that were buying this stuff? I mean, was it just all hedge funds? Was it pension funds? Was it large institutions that said, you know, like you say, we need to have a certain amount of AAA assets on our books, and this one's paying a much higher interest rate there, or theoretically will pay a higher interest rate than any other AAA product?
It was a whole range of clients. In one of the deals, the main client was Morgan Stanley, and they lost in the Hudson deal. They lost $960 million on that deal, which again, like, who cares, right? It's Morgan Stanley. Like, I'm not going to weep over them, except that within a year, the taxpayer was giving Morgan Stanley $10 billion to make up for its losses. You know, so you could pretty directly say that Goldman ended up taking that money out of the taxpayer's pocket. In other cases, you know, there was a Korean hedge fund that bought into the notorious Timberwolf deal, and then I know I talked to some guys at a now defunct Australian hedge fund that bought $100 million worth of this stuff at one point, and again, that was another car that exploded right out of the lot, and they were out of business within 2 months of doing that deal. So it was people all around the world, big companies and small, well, not small, but medium sized, and you know, a variety.
And now last year, the Goldman was sued by the SEC over something called Abacus.
Right.
And so how did they come out? I mean, tell me the details of how is that different from what was found here?
Well, Abacus is part of this report. They definitely, there's a long section on Abacus in here, what did they do in Abacus? There was a hedge fund guy named John Paulson, sort of a viper short seller guy who realized the market was tanking, wanted to bet against it. So he goes to Goldman and he says, I want you to help me put together a batch of the crappiest mortgages possible so that I can bet against them. But of course, in order to do that, you need to find somebody on the long side of the deal who will actually buy it so that Paulson could short it. So Goldman and Paulson worked together to create this gigantic batch of really deadly mortgage assets. Then Goldman went overseas and found a pair of banks, one Dutch, one German, who bought the bulk of this multi-billion-dollar deal without telling the banks that, in fact, you know, the assets in the deal had been selected specifically to lose by this guy, John Paulson, who was betting against them. So
Goldman, they vet these products and they choose them because they know they're going to self-destruct.
Right. Yeah, no, they were specifically chosen to fail. That was the idea. And Goldman called this service renting the platform. In other words, you know, these foreign banks, they wouldn't have bought this deal if they knew that the guy on the other side was a hedge fund, you know, carnivore who was betting against them. But Goldman essentially, quote unquote, rented their good name to John Paulson so that these banks would buy from Goldman, who they assumed was neutral. And for this service, Goldman only charged $15 million, which is a very small amount of money to commit that kind of infraction. But Paulson ended up making over $1 billion in that deal.
Well, good for him. I'm sure he must deserve it. I mean, you don't make that kind of money unless you're a really good person.
Exactly.
So when you hear this news that Eric Schneiderman is starting to investigate these guys, do you have a feeling that do you know anything as to whether or not this is the type of stuff he's pursuing at this point?
You know, well, it's in the general ballpark of that. I mean, I think this is that had more to do with you know, CDO origination and some other things that were, you know, sort of mildly tangential. I think the things that I heard about this morning also involved defrauding the government. So you know, that some of these banks were, for instance, you know, charging the government for FHA properties that actually had where they'd actually paid a lot less in the open market to get them. So it's a different thing, but you know, the general idea of going after banks, and they're the big ones, Bank of America, Citibank, and that sort of thing. That's a good thing. I mean, it's definitely but you know, what I was writing about in this piece is, you know, I think there was a highly symbolic moment, you know, last year when Goldman Sachs, which is the top company on Wall Street, when they came to Washington to talk about all this stuff, and they basically just brazenly lied in their testimony and walked away from it. We're still waiting for the government's full response on that, and that's what we're talking about.
And this committee, do they formally refer it to the Department of Justice, or they just put it out there and just say, we're done?
No, they deliver it, but they don't have any relationship with the Department of Justice. They're in the same boat that we are. You know, Levin, when the report was done, he wrote a letter to Eric Holder at the Justice Department and said, hey, you know, we think you should look into this. That doesn't mean that they're going to do anything. They don't have any special pull there. So we're all in the same boat.
All right. Well, Matt Taibbi, thank you so much. The piece is in this month's Rolling Stone, folks. I encourage you go read it. I think you can read it online or pick up the magazine. Why not pick up the magazine? Right?
I mean, all right. Excellent, Sam. Thanks very much, man.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Matt Taibbi, we're going to take a break. We will come back. Got another couple of stories. We'll come back also with a clip of Taibbi on CNN with the inestimably not bright Meghan McCardle. We'll be right back. All right, folks, appreciate your patience. Those of you listening live, we had a little technical difficulties. You had to wait a couple of minutes. So you got a chance to listen to some good music. What are you going to do? You going to complain about it? Oh, this one house cleaning note. If there's anyone out there who knows where Mila's library book is, apparently it's not Little Red Riding Hood, it's just Red Riding Hood. She's freaking out about it. She's very conscientious about returning her library books. And she's just about to start reading chapter books now, and she's worried that she's going to be penalized in some way if she doesn't get this library back. I don't know where it is. If anyone's seen it, please email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. You can tweet me. Just if you have the book, if it somehow got into your knapsack, no questions asked. Let me know. We just want the book back. And also, in that vein, if you want to help out by becoming a Majority Report member so that I can pay the enormous fees that will be associated with not being able to return this book to the PS library, please do. Your support is essential to keeping the show going. I have a certain window of time where we have to meet and reach a certain number of members to be able to keep the show going. We have been on pace. We are now falling off pace. Because as we get new members in, they don't understand. As we get new listeners, they don't fully appreciate yet how important this show is to them. So if you can become a member, please, we desperately need your help. And it would be much appreciated. We have a lot of things in the works. We're starting to do a web design. We're going to have a new logo soon. We're trying to figure out how to make this camera work, get the sound in there for improved YouTubes. Once we get that going, then I can start filling in for other people in other programs. It'll be great, folks. You will love it. Be a part of this. Meanwhile, let's play this clip of... I love this. This clip was fantastic. And you can see more of it at Crooks and Liars. But here, play a segment of it.
Megan, I think Matt wants to see a perp walk, wants to see somebody from Goldman arrested for something or charged with something. What do you think has to happen? Because clearly, whether or not you think Goldman broke any laws, any of us who followed this got the impression that they perhaps were not dealing in the best interests of some of their clients.
I think that they probably aren't, just like most vendors aren't always like look to their own interests before the interest of their clients.
Now, not terribly relevant in this conversation with Matt Taibbi, but just remember what Megan McArdle just said. Private vendors, they don't first look to the benefit of their clients. They look to the benefit of themselves. So as you hear conservatives, this is a completely off point, but it's a good point to make. As you hear conservatives talk about privatizing public services, remember, they know that job number one is to benefit the vendor, not the clients. They know this. They can talk about efficiencies all they want. They can talk about businesses do it better. But they know the bottom line is business does not perform a service for the benefit of its clients. So whether you are privatizing the buses that are supposed to take people out of New Orleans and they subcontract it to somebody else and they wait to the last minute because they don't want to lose money, if they're going to err, they're not going to err on the side of being too safe and protective of people. They're going to err on the side that saves them money. If we're going to administer prisons, we're going to cut corners because that's in our benefit. It's not in the benefit of the client, but that's what businesses do. Okay, continue.
They probably aren't, just like most vendors aren't always like look to their own interests before the interest of their clients.
Yes, thank you.
But here's the thing. Like, I think that there is a sort of a real desire to have a sense of closure on this, a desire to track down a villain, figure out who did this to us. And I think that really underweights the power of human stupidity.
Okay, so there you have it. I really think the idea of trying to find out if there was someone who did something wrong here really doesn't give enough credit to how stupid people can be. And, you know, you walk into a situation where someone tells you they're selling you a brand new car, and it turns out that it was actually pulled out of a swamp and just cleaned up. Well, then you're an idiot. That's what business is. We're going to provide services for the government. We're going to privatize Social Security. We're going to provide health insurance on the private market for 65-year-olds. You believed us? You're stupid. You're stupid. That's business. Can't do business without having an idiot for a client.
It really underweights the power of human stupidity. Greed, stupidity, and like poor system design can produce really terrible results even without anyone doing anything illegal.
How are you not ashamed to do the job that you do? How are you not ashamed to apologize for these billionaires who ripped off ordinary people? I can't believe that you
These weren't ordinary people. A hedge fund is not an ordinary person.
Well, no, how about this?
I can't believe that you've met hedge fund managers.
They ripped off $1 billion from Morgan Stanley, which then in turn took a $10 billion bailout from the taxpayer. Ergo, they ripped us off.
How do I answer that? I think that, you know, in fact, they do deals with big banks. I don't, you know, there's questions about how we should have done those bailouts. But the fact is, it's not Goldman Sachs' responsibility to make sure that Morgan Stanley makes money.
Yeah, I mean, part of the
problem. Any more than it's the Atlantic's responsibility to make sure that Rolling Stone makes money.
Good point. I'll just leave it right there.
I don't know how that makes sense in any planet in any universe. That is just insane.
Yeah, I love it. You got to appreciate Matt Taibbi going on there and saying those type of things. fantastic. He's wonderful. And speaking of suckers, after considerable deliberation and reflection, I've decided not to pursue the office of the presidency. This decision does not come easily without regret, especially when my potential candidacy continues to be validated by ranking at the top of the Republican contenders in polls across the country. I maintain the strong conviction. What's that?
Yucky sex.
Oh. No. What are you doing this for, Trump?
Yeah.
That if I were to run, I would be able to win the primary and ultimately the general election. As I said to Meatloaf when I was firing Gary Busey, you're fired. I could be president. What a douchebag. What a douchebag. God, I can't wait for him to go bankrupt again. I can't wait for him to go bankrupt again. What an embarrassing schmuck that guy is. Now the real question is, who are the Republicans going to support? What reality show host are they going to support now? Does Snooki have a new show? Who's Snooki? What about the, what's the guy's name? The contender or the
situation.
Problem?
The situation. They're filming Jersey Shore 4 in Italy right now.
In Italy? Oh, that must be, they're working on foreign policy. The Situation will come back and now he's going to be a foreign policy expert.
The season finale.
I went to Italy, and I'll tell the Chinese the same thing I told the Italy. I won't be afraid to swear at you during negotiations. What an embarrassment. What an embarrassment the media is. What an embarrassment for NBC. What an embarrassment. Same with Huckabee. I went on that CNN show, and I think I said, because, you know, I had to come up with a joke literally in five, you know, because I had no idea what the segment was until I hear a voice going like,
sir, it's melted like this. I can't see.
There's no picture. I'm sitting in a room all by myself. I don't know why I need to go into CNN to do that. I sit in a room by myself.
Okay, now it's the funniest four. We got three people here to tell funny jokes. You got 20 seconds each. And let's start with you, Will. Okay, thank you, Will. Rather, Sam, how about you?
And I had no idea. So all I said was like, Huckabee, why did he decide to leave? Well, I guess it deals with a calculator and the capacity to go to that all-you-can-eat buffet without worrying about it. Because the dude was like, I can become a millionaire a couple of times over, or I could be president. I could dine with foreign dignitaries or eat anything I want. That's not it. We need some other song here. That's what I needed, some song really just like the summer blockbuster. I can eat all I want. No, that's not it. I got to get like a... I don't know what I'm thinking about. Whatever. You get my point, folks. And meanwhile, Newt Gingrich, I guess, is going to be the only guy who's going to be able to provide us any real pleasure. Well, that's not true. Some other idiot will come out of the woodwork with these guys. They climb out of their clown cars. Where is this story? This is just wonderful. You got Newt Gingrich literally changing his opinion about mandates every 5 minutes. This poor guy, I think it was somebody tweeted something that Newt Gingrich reminds him of the guy who got out of Shawshank Redemption, the old guy, and he gets out of prison after 30 years and he just doesn't know what the hell's going on anymore. And that's why Newt's like looking around 24-hour news service. Hell, when I in 95, I could just spew my bullshit and nobody could catch me on it. There was no internet. Now he comes out and every 5 minutes he's changing his position and he's getting salamied. Fox News, am I right, played this Fox clip News, yeah. From his from a town hall in Iowa. Listen to this.
You just did that, Paul Ryan. It's unbelievable.
I didn't do anything.
Yes, you did. You undercut him in the scale. I said, oh, I shared an embarrassment to our party.
I'm sorry you feel that. Why don't you get out before you make a bigger fool of yourself?
You're an embarrassment to our party by knocking on the Paul Ryan proposal, which, if you're a Republican, understand, all of your leadership in the legislative branch have abandoned it because they know it's a big stinking loser with the American public. And you should understand that if there is no destruction of Medicare in the Paul Ryan budget plan, there is no budget plan. It's just another, it's just a plan to cut taxes. It doesn't in any way balance the budget. It creates a massive deficit. It's a joke. And meanwhile, Governor Nikki Haley is hammering Gingrich over his Medicare remarks. It's unbelievable. And the only lament I have about how ridiculous these Republicans are is that it enables Democrats to act like corporate tools, because they don't need to provide any genuine leadership for the rest of the people in this country, because they're running against a bunch of monkeys. No, scratch that. What's down in the evolutionary chain from monkeys?
Pigs.
No, scratch that. Pigs have actually are very intelligent. They have a lot of emotion. What's below that?
How far below? Are we talking like amoebas or?
Somewhere between amoebas and pigs.
All right.
Somebody help me out here. What animals just like, they're like, muskrats sort of, or, what's the word I'm looking for? They're not, what are those little, they're not very bright, those guys. They can't see anything. They just stumble around in the dark.
Moles?
Oh, Jesus Christ. You guys.
You're giving us the entire animal kingdom to work with.
I need some backup here. Let's just face it. These guys.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. These guys have never been outside of city before. One more story, and then, well, let's take it a couple more minutes. Federal pension proposal may make public sector work less attractive. Wow, that's not surprising. A proposal to significantly increase payroll deductions of federal workers to contribute to the federal pension fund may make public service less attractive. And here's why, folks. The deal that has been made with federal workers and state and municipal workers, that guy I interviewed in Wisconsin who was marching against Scott Walker. He's like, look, I didn't have the opportunity to go to college. All right? I had an opportunity to take a job for 20 grand a year, whatever it was, in the sanitation department. I work my ass off. They keep cutting and cutting and cutting and make my job harder. We cover three times the size of area with one-third less the crew that we used to have. But I did this, and I worked this hard because I had a guaranteed pension. And he says, and the idea that they would take that away from me is reprehensible. And he's right. And frankly, these jobs, these are not the best jobs in the world, folks. And they are underpaid. Even if you include the benefits of health and retirement pensions, on average, federal, state, municipal workers make anywhere from 5 to 15% less than they would in the private sector with the equivalent education. But people choose, and it's not a stupid choice unless you calculate the idea that someday the people who hired you essentially lied to you. That I'm willing to take less pay now to not worry about health care and to not worry about my pension. That's actually a pretty smart choice. I would make that choice. And now what we're doing after all these years these guys have been working, we're going to screw them out of their pension. Or we're going to cut it. Or we're going to cut their pay even more. Who's going to go into these jobs? That's not surprising. And the Office of Personnel Management statistics suggest that as much as 60% of the federal workforce is eligible to retire in the next 10 years. Now, with an economy like this, they may not choose to do that. So we're going to have a older federal workforce. It's going to keep younger people out of it, and younger people aren't going to want to go into it because it doesn't have the same benefits. Meanwhile, study just released by the Urban Land Institute shows the United States has fallen behind three emerging economic competitors, Brazil, China, and India, in rebuilding and expanding an overloaded and deteriorating transportation network that is desperately needed to remain competitive. Over the next 5 to 10 years, public concerns will grow over evident declines in the condition of the infrastructure. Report lends global perspective to an issue addressed last fall by a panel of 80 experts led by former transportation secretaries Norma Mineta and Samuel K. Skinner. That group concluded that as much as $262 billion a year must be spent on U.S. highways, rail networks, and air transportation systems. Congress has failed to approve two major bills that allow for long-term funding and planning for aviation and transportation. The FAA has been operating under a funding bill that expired in 07 and has been extended 18 times, which means they can't make any long-term plans. And that's all it is when you talk about infrastructure. The United States, the Institute report concludes, needs to invest $2 trillion to rebuild roads, bridges, water lines, sewage systems, and dams that are reaching the end of their planned life. We should have been doing that with the stimulus. We should have been investing a lot more in that. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. We're going to go to the flip side. I'll give you a couple extra minutes on the flip side because we had a couple of this and then that and then this and then that. Folks, please, if you have the opportunity to use the Amazon link at Majority FM, please. You will redistribute wealth to those corporate mofos over at Amazon and allow this corporate mofo to benefit. And, frankly, continue my ability to go on to Radigan yesterday, say the words, we're in the midst of a class war. It's nothing to do with, big government and big corporations. It's just the rich are screwing us. And I enjoy going on these shows and being the only person sitting on the panel who's not being paid by the Koch brothers or being paid by a weapons manufacturer or being paid by some large institute, waiting on the largesse of big institutional money.
George Soros pulled out of our show.
I didn't want to mention that. Yeah, Soros and I are not talking right now. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.